Hello and welcome to Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi?
Sci-Fi.
Yes, Sci-Fi, 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 the podcast in which three pseudo-random gentlemen read science fiction or fantasy books in audiobook form and discuss them.
Who are you calling pseudo?
I'm certainly not calling you gentlemen.
Is that P-pseudo or S-U-pseudo?
S-U. So anyway, this week, more or less, we are discussing The Obelisk Gate by N.K. Jemisin. So we shall begin with a reading from the back of the book. This is the way the world ends for the last time. The season of endings grows darker as civilization fades into the long, cold night. Essun, once Demaya, once Cyanite, now Avenger, has found shelter but not her daughter. Instead, there is Alabaster Tenring, destroyer of the world, with a request. But if Essun does what he asks, it would seal the fate of the stillness forever. Far away, her daughter Nasun is growing in power, and her choices will break the world. Now, I do want to congratulate them on having a fairly short synopsis, however, one that doesn't explain anything to anyone whatsoever.
Is that why I'm so lost?
No, that's because you're trapped on an island.
Is that like the planet Earth, the island?
This island Earth, yes.
Dun, dun, dun.
All right. So, what did people think of this book? Kevin, shall we start with you?
I guess we could.
Kevin, let's start with you.
Oh, okay. So, actually, yeah, I did like it. It took me a little bit to remember what the hell happened in the first book. So, but once that kind of came back, then it made a little more sense.
Are we allowed to spoil the first book again?
Sure,
the
I guess.
Moon. You've listened to all of our older episodes, right?
Right. Well, I'm pretty sure that you could listen to the entirety of our previous episode about the previous book in this series and not actually understand anything that was going on in the book either, because we had forgotten everything about it by the time we were doing the review.
And again, for this one?
Well, here we at least took a bit of notes.
Speak for yourself.
Yes, I am. Kevin, were you done with your opinion?
Yes, it was favorable.
Good.
I enjoyed the Earth Jedi goodness. Everything was great.
Barry.
It still had some confusing bits, but...
Absolutely. Barry, what did you have to say?
Make Earth great again. Bring back the moon.
Yes. We will be ceremoniously throwing Barry to the wolves at the end of this podcast.
I warned you.
Well, yes, as we found out in the last sentence of the first book, this series is what happens after Space 1999.
What Kevin is referring to there is, at the end of the first book, one character asks another, have you ever heard of a moon? Which is actually up for a certain amount of debate as to whether or not moons are planets right now, but let's leave the IAU out of this. Okay.
So, I liked it as much as the first book.
Okay.
Very. You'll have to refer to our previous podcast to see what I thought of that one.
Okay, great.
It's a pointer.
I thought that this was a good middle step in a series. This is the second in a trilogy, and so it actually had a decent ending for the second part of a trilogy. There was an exciting ending, even though it didn't wrap up the whole series or even answer a whole lot of questions.
Yeah, there was a lot of continued world building,
right,
and introspection.
And there's a whole lot of information dumping as to exactly what is where and when, and further elucidation of the concepts presented in the first book.
How to live and prosper within your calm.
Exactly. The only thing that I kind of wished that they had stuck with was, initially the magic system in this series was fairly simple.
It was very one-dimensional.
Yeah, it was, you know, you have energy here and you transfer it over there. And now they're adding in something that they're just literally calling magic.
But not midichlorians.
But not midichlorians. And I wasn't entirely sure whether I liked that or not.
The midichlorian part?
The magic part, yes.
It was a kind of an abrupt introduction for me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't quite understand where it was going.
Exactly.
We can discuss it in our more spoilery section than our less spoilery section now.
Yes. Great. So I guess it is time for us to all be slowly eaten by stone, and then we will return as stone eaters in the next section where we can all talk spoilers until
put me in the earth.
The next season.
Yay.
We shall return, for we are Sci-Fi.
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 And welcome back to our spoiler section, where we will discuss things as previously mentioned until the sixth season, which is not a thing, so.
There was the acid season, I believe.
Well, that was the 60s.
Yeah, I'm kind of hoping to go back.
We'll get a flashback at some point. All right, so usual, did we have any particular favorite scenes? I believe, Kevin, you had one?
Yeah, I did actually like very close to the beginning. We have basically what happens to the Guardian, which I've now forgotten his name.
Shaffa, when the walls fell.
Yeah, oh, God. Yes, so Shaffa, when the walls fell. Shaffa is one. Is sort of the, I guess he's kind of considered a bad guy in the first book. He's at least not neutral or very, very good, at least from the point of view of...
He's trying to kill our main characters or bring them under autocratic control, so that's usually a villain.
Hey, yeah. It's a job.
Hello, Frank. Hello, Jim.
Yeah.
Yes.
It becomes a little more, you know, ambiguous or multidimensional in this book. But basically, you know, we're reminded that he was on a ship when all sorts of crazy things happened at the end of the first book, when the powers of one of the obelisks was released.
Right.
And so the ship apparently gets destroyed and he's sort of underwater in the ocean and he's suffocating. But this is when you kind of discover, I don't think they ever talked about it in the first book, or I'd totally forgotten, that the Guardians are almost immortal and super powerful.
Right. They indicate that they're different, and I forget, there was some connection made between them and the Origins in the first book.
Yeah, and they, I don't remember. I'd have to reread the first book to see how much they went into it. So anyway, yeah, in this book we find out that they, you know, poke some bad metal into their skull and make them quasi-immortal and super powerful. There's kind of like another sentience kind of stuck in this metal bit or something that's controlling them and slash helping them. So he essentially is drowning. This thing kind of says, hey, if you kind of like destroy half your brain and essentially like, you know, remove your personality, you can continue living. And at the time he's like, no, I'd rather die. And then like, you know, once he's actually is dying, the thing kind of says, hey, I'm taking over now. You've lost your will. And like the only thing he had left really was his name. And that was about it. And
right. I had kind of mixed feelings about that particular scene because I kind of felt that they were bringing back a character that had died in the previous book. But if he had sort of died off screen, then maybe it was okay.
Yeah, I didn't remember him dying in the previous book. So for me, I guess that wasn't, wasn't an issue. But in this case, they kind of did kill him off in a weird way, right? They're just like, well, you're back, but you're not really yourself. I mean,
right. They basically neutered his personality.
I mean, and even more so than like, you know, when Gandalf dies, right? And then Gandalf comes back, but and he's, you know, now I'm Gandalf the White, right, not right. Gandalf he's the Gray.
Shaffa the White now.
So it's, you know, kind of like that, but, you know, even less of his personality remains.
Okay. Barry, did you have a favorite scene?
I think the culmination to the battle scene was probably my favorite.
The March of the Bug Army?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty awesome.
What were they called? The heat bugs? I forget.
Boil bugs?
Boil bugs. That was it. Yeah, the Battle of the Boil Bugs.
Love that alliteration.
Yeah, gotta go it.
You know, the whole the onyx obelisk.
Yeah. It's true. This is all about alliteration.
Yes.
And it, I imagine this book is like awesome if you're actually like a geologist. You're like, yeah, and then they mentioned this mineral.
Well, I'm so glad that I spent so much time of my youth, you know, reading, you know, like the original D&D, you know, treasure tables, because you know,
right.
It exposed me to all these words.
Yeah, all these things that normally you
Chalcedony
wouldn't
know. And
yeah.
I was like, wow, it finally paid off.
Good job. Especially with the continued world building, this definitely had the feel of either the author is writing an RPG kind of on the side in their head. They wrote the book using their own RPG, or you can easily imagine an RPG if you are familiar with them, one of those.
Yeah. This is now easily transcribable into Savage Worlds game system.
Okay, sure. A scene that stood out for me was when the daughter was sort of going through this power awakening, and then this boy tries to sort of wake her up and she statues him.
Whoops. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
It got away from me there.
Overall, I was really enjoying this. I should have said this in the review section. You know, the only problem was that it all got a little overcomplicated for an audiobook at times. As we started out, I had no recollection of who anybody was. And the problem is that Esun, our main character, has at least three names. She was born.
Right.
Right. Born to Maya, then she became Cyanite, and then now is Esun. And that was all very carefully covered in the first book, but it's been a little while, and I kept on just like, okay, I forget. I know a bunch of these people are the same person, but I don't remember who. Is Nasun also Esun? In which case, stupid disguise name.
Yeah, and then you're like, no, no, that was the daughter. But
that's the daughter.
And then Essie, of course.
Right. Yeah, that all became very confusing.
This is all beginning to make more sense to me now.
Right. And so I thought that the ending was reasonable. We had sort of the big scene where Esun uses the obelisk gate and sort of briefly becomes very close to all powerful.
Right. That was pretty cool.
Yeah. And then I kind of assumed that this was going to be the, oh, and it changes her forever. And it does, because I think her arm turns to stone. I was a little unclear.
Yeah, part of it. Well, she's also in a coma.
Right.
See, that was the thing, is I thought that this is when she'd be like, oh, well, while I'm here, let me just grab the moon for a second. And then they didn't do that. And I was like, oh.
There's going to be a third book.
Well, right. And isn't it already out? I forget now, but.
At some point, yes.
Yeah. Anyway, and so that was a thing that kind of confused me until I actually, you know, I was rereading it at like three times speed for the last day, just to kind of like try to remind myself of things I missed or something or forgot. And I did come across the thing that confused me, where I thought at the end there's multiple factions of Stone Eaters and things. And so there was Nasun and her Stone Eater, and then there was our main characters, you know, or the adults essentially, and the Stone Eaters that they had. And, you know, Cyanide, or whichever we're going to use, Esun and Alabaster want to bring the moon back. You know, at the end of the first book, that's what Alabaster did, was he sort of, you know, did one moon course correction. And the Stone Eater has told us, well, you know, you need to do one more to bring it back into orbit. So, you know,
if it weren't in orbit, it would never come back.
Well, right. But into it's stable,
less eccentric orbit.
Yeah. A closer elliptical orbit. So
a rounder one.
Yes. And she says, I'll do that. And that's what they want. And then at the end of the book, I was thinking, but that's what, you know, sort of the steel, whatever his name was, the other Stone Eater said that he wanted, you know, Nasun to do also. And you're like, but right. I thought they were conflicting. And why is it that they both want the same thing?
Exactly. So Esun is at one place, and she seems to be preparing to bring back the moon. And then it seems like we're being set up for a big conflict between her and her daughter, Nasun, who is at this colony called Lost Moon, I guess, or Found Moon. That was it.
Something like that.
Yeah. Lost Moon was Apollo 13.
It's the one that Shafa's running, right?
Yes.
Who also has a couple Stone Eaters, or at least one there. And so when I was rereading it, there is like one line in the rest of the book where I don't remember the name of the Stone Eater now, but Esun's, you know, buddy Hoa, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, Hoa says, I think it is Hoa anyway, or one of the ones in their camp.
It's written down in front of you.
No, I know. But there's also the one that she called, like, you know, red hair or like something like that or whatever. That was the one that's Alabaster's friend.
Right.
Anyway. So one of them told her, oh, he also wants to open the obelisk gate, but for his own purposes. I mean, it was unclear whether he wanted to bring the moon back, I forget now, or whether he just wanted to do something else with the moon. But he says, well, he wants the gate for his own purposes, not to bring the moon back like we want exactly. So I guess there was a line there that kind of said, oh, yeah, they're not actually trying to do the same thing, even though he was saying that's what he wanted later. So that's kind of one confusing bit I found until the reread.
Okay, so this is actually something I hadn't really thought about. Is the moon just really, really absent? Or is it when the moon comes back that its gravitational pull sets off all of these earthquakes? That's the normal seasons.
So I think when the moon, you know, sort of comes slingshotting past the Earth now, I think that's when the seasons, you know, sort of restart. And the reason you're not seeing seasons on a regular basis is that, you know, people are basically, you know, altering the orbit slightly every time it comes by a little bit.
Right. It's like a chaotic orbit. It's not like a stable one, I guess, or something.
Well, they're basically trying to fix it when they can. And then, you know, it kind of either brings the season closer or pushes it farther out in time.
Yeah, I guess we don't know if anybody else has tried to change the moon's orbit before Alabaster or not.
Right. So the sort of establishment origins, the fulcrum, they are all trained not to look at the sky. Hey, there's nothing up there. Pay no attention to the sky. And that's apparently the new thing that these folks are doing, is actually trying to cast their minds upwards and find the moon.
Right. It takes a lot of kind of complex world building, essentially, to say, first, okay, we, you know, like you were saying, we have this basic energy movement magic system, and then say, oh, by the way, that's not really the powerful part of the magic system, but you've been trained to not see the really powerful part because it can easily get away from us controlling you if you know how to use that part of the magic and not just the heat energy or something.
Right. And they literally call this extra part magic.
Right.
And it seems to be like a network of formerly living cells. I mean, they were talking about limestone and how it was built by...
Yeah, they said like chalcedony or something like that, which, and then they said, okay, it's like, you know, former, you know, sea life that's fossilized. And so they basically said, oh, magic is anything that was once alive in some form or is currently alive, contains magic in some way.
Right. Which is lovely, but kind of midichlorians.
Yeah. And that was actually the funny thing was, at first, when I heard them say, oh, and what's this thing called? And I was just like, oh God, they're going to say midichlorians. I mean, not really, but I was thinking they're bringing midichlorians into this. I'm like, God, do they really have to do that? And then he's like, it's called magic. And then I'm like, okay, I guess it's kind of like anti-midichlorians, because they actually just said, oh no, it's magic. And then I'm like, oh, okay, I guess they're just kind of not really making fun of it, but it's kind of like it has the opposite effect almost.
Right.
Because, you know, it's a magic word that is magic, but we're going to call it not magic.
Exactly. It's not a reductive explanation. It isn't a very explanatory explanation, but...
And he was kind of like, it doesn't matter what it's called, you know?
Right.
And she's never heard the word magic before, apparently, so...
Okay, so what do people think about the first, second, and third person aspects of this? I was trying to figure out what the hell was going on, because...
It's kind of hard to keep track of when you're driving around.
Yes. We've got what seems to be a story being told to some future version of Esun about her own exploits.
Right, and so... I kind of go in between, you know, not even noticing it's kind of odd, because most books don't, you know, shift, you know, the person this way. And also it's not common to have a second person book. So it's like when that happens, you kind of go, oh, you know, you're doing this, you're doing that. And I'm like, oh, okay. Well, you know, it wasn't really distracting, but it was interesting, I guess. But, but then, yeah, I was having a hard time figuring it out, because sometimes there was I, and then that I seemed to be different sometimes, but I wasn't sure. Part of me is like, was I supposed to be the Earth? Was it one of the Stone Eaters? Because sometimes for sure, it's definitely one of the Stone Eaters when they say I.
Right. I thought that I was at least once Hoa.
Yeah. And because there was one scene where it says like, I, you know, basically like, you know, fell in love with Esun, or I was, you know, at least liked Esun or something at one point. And
I'm wondering if in the print book, it's, you know, like a different font or something.
Could very well be.
You know, it's something that's, you know, it sort of goes over everybody's head when you just listen to it.
I glanced at the Kindle version and I didn't see anything that was, you know, vastly different typefaces for different kinds of things. I do have to praise the reader a bit. Praise the reader.
All praise the leader. Reader.
Because she was very good at, if something was supposed to be in quotes or not understood, she was good at sort of pausing just the right amount of time.
Right. She wasn't a fast reader for sure, because like I put this on 3x speed and I could still understand what she was saying, but that's not a detriment, I don't think, really. It was just, I noticed that when I put it on 3x, but yeah, most of the time, I thought she did a good job.
Well, she did, I thought, an amazing performance during the obelisk gate scene where Esun is sort of hovering over the ground, or at least that was sort of how I was feeling it.
Yeah.
That she was sort of like flying in midair and was trying to understand what the hell to do next. And then, you know, Apparently, she's just trying to say the word love, but which is kind of hokey if she just had said love. But it was just like, love.
And that's right. Yeah, I remember that part.
I assumed that that was probably something that was, you know, all in capital letters
and stuff or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And that was really well performed. Because it sort of took me by surprise. How it's something about her performance kind of reached me in a way that was not necessarily going to happen in that scene otherwise.
Right.
All right.
Yeah, it could have very easily come off very flat and not had any impact whatsoever.
Exactly.
And I believe our reader was Robin Miles.
Okay. Well, yeah, we all have our beliefs.
Yes, this book definitely falls under the, you know, my brain likes to know how things are spelled. So it's sort of like, now that I see how everything's spelled, it's totally different than it was, than my brain suggested.
Right. I never understood where Raga came from.
Yeah, I always thought it was
R-A-G-A.
Yeah. Actually, I always thought it was R-A-G-A, not J.
Yeah, that's what we said.
Okay, good. I'm glad you agree with me then.
Yes. We are all one.
Yes. So, yes, that leads to, the fantastic racism, which is a TV trope name, not my personal coinage. There is sort of a discussion of happening about race here, even though these, shall we say, normal races have all changed. And she's talking quite a bit about people of this coast and that coast and how this person's got this color skin and that color skin. And normal racism doesn't seem to be a big deal anymore. But fantastic racism.
I think that there's just not enough people left to.
Right, exactly.
Well, yeah, it's like there was one scene maybe where they, you know, the children sort of were like, oh, can I touch your hair? And then the other one said, oh, can I touch yours? And they kind of go, they kind of giggled and said, yeah, this is kind of stupid to even like, you know, talk right. about it. And they all were friends or whatever. It's the standard sci-fi thing of, well, we can have a discussion about a topic that normally would be difficult by making it, you know, very different, you know, like Star Trek does or whatever. So,
right. And it's weird. I actually feel kind of like an aversion to saying Raga.
yeah.
Because it's a slur, even though it's not a slur against anybody that actually exists.
Yes. In the book, it's considered a slur of origin and they...
Right, because it's O-R-O-G-E-N.
So it's like an abbreviation.
Right.
And they've been sort of taught by the Guardians, essentially, that basically everybody is like, oh, if you're an origin, you're horrible and dangerous unless you're maybe controlled by the Fulcrum. And you're a member of the Fulcrum, you're kind of like, you can do lots of powerful things, you know, under supervision. Otherwise, if you're just roaming free, that you should be killed, is the general thought of the populace.
Exactly. And then... even in Castrema, which is led by an origin and has a lot of origins in it, there's this sort of anti-origin groundswell at the end, which is, oh, well, Ika's okay. You know, she's earned her place, but we only really need one origin.
Right. And, you know, we can't really trust them. And at some point, that's when Essun kind of comes back. You know, they're having a vote. Mm-hmm. About like, well, who, you know, who's human,
the island?
Basically. Yeah. Right. And she kind of comes up, she like incinerates the voting box with the votes and it has this line where it's like, and they breathed in their, you know, little particles of their votes and it probably wouldn't haunt them. Like, and she's like, no votes, you know, no one gets to decide who's human and who's not, you know, everybody is, you know, in this together basically.
Exactly.
Your opinion doesn't matter.
Right. And then there's this whole, I mean, throughout the entire book, there's, you know, Jija, who, you know, killed his toddler, who was an origin in the first book that happens. And they kind of redo it again at the beginning of this book just to make it, you know, extra horrifying. in case you forgot.
Shows it from the daughter's perspective.
Right. So the daughter, who is also an origin, you know, so her brother's killed, you know, by her father, you know, because he just finds out, oh, crap, you know, you're a magic user, you know, not safe. You know, we find out later that he had a personal experience. A friend of his was killed by accident by an origin. Mm-hmm. He can't bring himself to kill his daughter, but he's bringing her to some place that can, quote, cure it and make her not an origin anymore. So there's definitely a lot of...
And yet, of course, you know, the place he takes her to is essentially just a training center for origins, and none of them are trying to cure them.
Right. They just are, you know, they go through this thing of... And you're... They kind of seem to say, yeah, technically we can cure you, but you have to be good enough to sort of like disable it in yourself. And by then it's like, why would you do that? Because you're powerful at that point. Like, But technically you could if you really, really wanted to.
Yes, exactly.
It was sort of a sad arc there where, you know, he's not able to overcome his hatred of Origins or whatever, however you want to term it. But, you know, up to the point at the very end where his daughter kind of goes from being controlled by him, afraid of him, to being powerful enough to protect herself. And she's just sort of stringing him along, controlling him just because, you know, he was her dad. And then at some point, she doesn't really even have really fond feelings for him anymore because she could see how he's still filled with hatred all the time about it. And
there was some incident that happened, and the point was made that this was the end of Nasun's childhood, that she would keep on calling her dad daddy, but only to control him.
Right. It was very manipulative.
Right.
And, you know, just for her survival. But then at the very end, she tells him, I'm not going to stop doing this. I like it. And he's just like, you know, I knew this was a lie, you know, and all this stuff finally. And he has a knife. He's going to kill her. And she's just kind of
that
like,
that seemed like a very unequal battle.
Yeah. And, you know, and like, she's sitting there,
I've got a nuclear weapon. Well, I've got a knife.
Yeah. And she's kind of thinking he meant something once. Maybe our time together can still mean something. And he still is like, nope, I'm still going to kill you. So she kills him instead. But it was sort of like, you know, it's like that arc didn't go well.
Long term, only one of them was going to survive unless they could really split up.
Wow, it's almost like a Luke Anakin thing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, because they're addressing, you know, potentially, if you want to view it that way, you know, racism and all sorts of isms, right?
Right.
And I mean, there's different characters where some do change and some, like, he's just set in his ways and, you know, to the point that he's willing to kill his own child to, quote, fix it. I mean, I don't know what he was trying to do other than just sort of like, it's better that she's dead than that she's like this horrible origin or something like that. And
right.
I mean, is it just me or is, you know, people don't really change their views in this book. They either, you know, go away or are killed by their daughter or
or are controlled by a small piece of metal in their head.
Right.
You know, do people really change their views in real life? It rarely happens.
Over a long period of time, I think people do, but
yeah, I think maybe a little bit of change happened. I'm trying to think if there's any specific instance I could think of. I mean, there's definitely a spectrum of imposed change in a sense, or like maybe very mild, like people getting used to an origin on some level,
yeah,
as opposed to like, oh, you're just evil. And
right. Essun sort of got over her snobbery at being a super well-trained.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
Origin. Although that was mostly, I didn't really see her taking much action on that.
Well, it was totally towards the very end that she's like, Alabaster had been trying to train her how to use, you know, magic instead of
Alabaster really did seem to be a terrible teacher.
Yeah. And they did kind of
really
say
couldn't
that,
get around. So,
yeah.
And you know, it isn't until the very, very end when she absolutely has to, that she gets the training from the non Fulcrum origin, which I don't remember her name either, Ika or whatever. Ika knows how to kind of make a network of origins. Mm-hmm. So it just takes, you know, basically half an hour of training by Ika for Essun to go, oh, well, that's how it works. And then she actually just says, well, if only I had known, you know, maybe, you know, Alabaster would still be alive. And then she kind of says, well, you know, he was really in pain. It was a kindness to put him out of his misery. You know, and then it's just like, you know, years later, she'll actually believe that or something.
Right, exactly.
And so, yeah, there's a lot of like the way the wording was, there's a lot of sort of like introspective kind of, you know, internal monologues.
Exactly. All right. Well, was there anything else we wanted to talk about? Oh, tea. So I actually couldn't remember if anybody had had any tea in this book whatsoever.
There was mention of safe, as was from the first book.
Ah, yes.
Which
wasn't really tea. That was more like
some weird root or something.
Yeah, but it would do something to warn people if there were poisons or something.
Yeah.
Some sort of adulterant.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I did a search for the word tea in the book, and what I came up with, there's a reference to Miss McKemba, a quiet old lady who smells like tea.
What kind of tea did she smell like?
It literally just said smelled like tea. That's the only mention of the word tea.
Like mint tea?
Mint tea.
So what part, where did she live? I don't even remember that at all, but
she smelled like tea.
Okay, good. She was in the book.
Does that really qualify as like a tea consumption reference? Or, I mean, we never really...
Let's talk about this more.
Yes.
Tea is good.
I would also like to welcome like our fourth host, Fridgie McFridgington.
Thank you, McFridgie.
So anything else that we wanted to talk about? I think we covered it all. Great.
I think the fridge is rather... got a solid statement all the way through.
All right. Well, until the refrigerator reveals itself as a next level origin and destroys us all by freezing us to death.
I'm actually hoping the door will open to another reality or something.
Zool.
Are you the keymaster?
No. Gozar, that is Sator.
All right. And until then, we have been Sci-Fi.
Sci-Fi.
Ghostbusters.
No.
Sci-fi. It's also sci-fi.